Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. This week's program is dedicated to Karen Norton O'Connor. She's been battling major illness. Karen has been devoted to peace and justice causes as a professional social worker and activist. She spent more than 10 years as public affairs director for WHUS Radio, a Pacifica affiliate at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. Karen served as an advisor to this and other radio programs going back to the 1980s and 90s, and she's been a true friend.
The international global activists who are behind the boycott, divestment, and sanction movements, not one of them is going to be fooled into being silent or stopping their activities just because negotiations are resuming. All the more so, we need to keep up the pressure.
Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation joins us. The title of his recent piece in Huffington Post is The Top 10 Reasons for Skepticism on Israeli-Palestinian Talks. First, this news about an oil and natural gas platform explosion about 100 miles off Louisiana's central coast in the Gulf of Mexico. An oil sheen had been detectable for about a mile near the site owned by Mariner Energy. Later, reports said that the sheen had disappeared. We've not yet been able to determine if that means that Mariner used dispersants in the area. According to an article on Deep Sea News, 50% of studies found that chemical additives like Corexit dispersant inhibited microbial degradation. That's the opposite of the goal. The other half of studies didn't find any significant difference between treatment and control groups. The most toxic components of oil, the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, are not biodegraded by dispersants. This has been known for at least 2 years. Marine biologist Samantha Joy of the University of Georgia told us she felt it was a mistake early on for BP to use the dispersants in the Gulf of Mexico.
Dispersed oil is something that cannot be cleaned up, cannot be remediated, cannot be removed. You know, there have been tests done with dispersants on specific organisms. They haven't been tested against, you know, Gulf of Mexico communities. We don't know how the microbial community in the Gulf of Mexico per se is going to respond to these dispersants. What if the organisms that are metabolizing this oil tend to be really hypersensitive to Corexit or some byproduct of Corexit breakdown? We simply don't know that.
Journalist Dar Jamail has been covering the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and reporting on health effects from Corexit.
It's an industrial solvent. It's extremely toxic. Some of the basic ways it affects people are, for example, if there's a woman who's pregnant and she's exposed to this person, she will lose her baby in a very short time. Literally, that baby will not remain alive. It's immune system depressant. It causes, it's mutagenic. I mean, these are just some of the basic things. And I mean, we have an extremely long list of what this stuff does to people. But the short version of the story is that it's extremely toxic on its own right. And then when it's mixed with oil, it of course becomes even more toxic. And we don't know exactly how much is out there. I think the number that BP and the government give of roughly 1.9 million gallons having been used, I think we can safely understand that that is a very, very, very low-end estimate.
Dar Jamail's article on Corexit at dahr.org. Josh Rubner is National Advocacy Director at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation in Washington, D.C. He says President Obama has set himself up for failure on Palestinian and Israeli peace talks. Josh Rubner, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the biggest problem with the talks that the White House and State Department has set up?
Well, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to envision how this renewed round of direct negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians will lead to even a semblance of a just peace between the two sides. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas was very strongly arm-twisted into attending these negotiations in the absence of a true Israeli commitment to freeze the colonization of Palestinian land, which is ostensibly set aside for an independent Palestinian state, which is supposedly the goal of these negotiations, and you have an Israeli negotiating team led by two people whose motives should be questioned. You have Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was recently caught in a leaked videotape from 2001, bragging about how he stopped the Oslo peace process back in the 1990s. And you have an Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who himself is a settler, who himself has called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. So it's really it really boggles the mind to understand how the Obama administration can expect negotiations to succeed under these circumstances.
We were seeing headlines that the Israeli leadership was rejecting any kind of overture from the United States, that they stop building illegal settlements in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, Palestinians being locked out of their own homes as Israelis come in. Now, that's been a scenario, a recipe for disaster in the past. We were hearing about it. We suddenly stopped hearing about it. It continued to go on, though, correct?
Absolutely. And this kind of points to the fact that the Obama administration has really been adrift in its policy towards Israel-Palestine since it entered into office. I think for President Obama's first 8 months in office, he had the right idea, which was to press for an Israeli freeze on colonization of Palestinian land as a precondition for resuming negotiations. But at last fall's UN General Assembly meeting, he did a complete about-face and said it's no longer necessary to have a settlement freeze. It's time to get back to negotiations, whether there's a freeze or not. And ever since then, he's been twisting the Palestinians' arms to return to the negotiating table under these very unpropitious circumstances. And, you know, as we've seen in the past, negotiations that take place under the cover of continued Israeli colonization of Palestinian land is a recipe for failure.
You know, we're seeing headlines that the Netanyahu administration is willing to give back land in Jerusalem for peace, even as we're now seeing terrible headlines about Hamas attacks that took the lives of four Jewish settlers. So it's a tough climate. I mean, it must be difficult. What is the message tonight?
The message for our vigil in front of the White House is that for negotiations to be successful between Israelis and Palestinians, they need to be based on very clear guiding principles or terms of reference in diplomatic talk, which are human rights, international law, and UN resolutions. And the problem with the way that the Obama administration has structured these negotiations is that there are explicitly no clear guiding principles for the talks, and George Mitchell, the special envoy for peace, actually said that the parties themselves will be able to determine how they're going to negotiate and on what basis they're going to negotiate. And to set these negotiations up without these clear principles and framework of UN resolutions and international law is also, again, a recipe for failure. And it's really difficult for me to understand why President Obama is attempting negotiations at this time, under these circumstances, without really a clear strategy of how to make them successful. To me, he's kind of floundering around for a foreign policy victory, given that he's not having a lot of success in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. So to me, dinner at the White House is really all about political theater and not about substance.
Also, what about the Israeli offer to return or restore some land to Palestinians? What kinds of offers or overtures are being made, and what is the reality at hand?
It's not at all clear what Netanyahu's offer towards Palestinians will be, and we've seen reports coming out of Israeli media circles in the past week or so that possibly the best thing that will come out of these negotiations, if anything comes out, is an agreement that will be shelved and implemented when the time is right. But it's not at all clear how much occupied territory Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be prepared to return to the Palestinians. But my best guess is that it will be significantly less than what was on offer 10 years ago during the Camp David negotiations, which Palestinians found unacceptable and not meeting the minimum requirements for a just peace. So it's really difficult to see how someone as committed to quote-unquote greater Israel as Netanyahu is will produce any kind of offer that Palestinians will find acceptable.
And right now, the Mahmoud Abbas is representing Palestinians. Hamas, under pressure right now, in fact, the Palestinian Authority making arrests in Gaza, tracking down members of Hamas in the killing of four settlers. Talk about the leadership in terms of what it means to Palestinians who might want to engage in peace talks and what they're up against.
Well, this is also another indication that the time is not necessarily conducive to negotiations, because it's no secret that the Palestinian leadership is very fractured, very disunited, and a lot of that has been the result of the United States and Israel playing these kind of divide and rule tactics over the Palestinian people. It should be remembered that Hamas legitimately won the legislative elections in 2006, and these elections were held at the urging of the Bush administration. So for Hamas to be completely sidelined from the political process, both by the United States, Israel, and the PLO, really means that there's a seat at the table that's not being filled. And Hamas demonstrated yesterday in its West Bank attack that it does still have the power and capability to make a statement and make a violent statement if it feels that it's going to be excluded from the political process. And what's kind of ironic about the way that these negotiations have been structured by Special Envoy for Middle East Peace George Mitchell is that they're completely at odds with his experience negotiating peace in Northern Ireland. And if you look through his reminiscence of those negotiations and you look through his writings and memoirs and so forth, you'll see that he places a lot of emphasis on the importance of having all the political parties around the negotiating table and recognizing that if you don't, then a deal is going to be unlikely to be implemented. So the lessons he learned in successfully negotiating in Northern Ireland, he has not applied to this situation here with Israel-Palestine. And the fact that Hamas is on the outside looking in means that they have effective veto power over whatever transpires in this negotiating process.
In your piece in Huffington Post, you write about the way President Obama set himself up for failure in these talks. On NPR, the discussion has been in part, you know, this week, quote, did the president set the bar too high? Just discuss what the media has been like on this in general.
Well, I do think that it is realistic for Israelis and Palestinians to conclude negotiations within a year, which is what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said is the aspirational goal for this round of negotiations. But I only believe that that's possible if Israel pre-commits to dismantling its 43-year illegal military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip, and to dismantling its apartheid policies towards Palestinians, whether they live in the occupied territories, whether they're treated as second-class citizens of Israel, or whether they're denied their rights as refugees exiled from their homes. If Israel pre-committed to ending these apartheid practices, absolutely negotiations could be wrapped up within a year. But given the fact that these negotiations are being led by Netanyahu, by Lieberman, by this extremist Israeli government, which has shown absolutely no indication that they're prepared to end their domination over Palestinian people, there's no way that these negotiations can be successfully concluded in any time frame, because they're not being done under legitimate and good faith efforts.
You also wrote about going through the budget to look at aid to Israel and aid to the Palestinians and to sort of try to figure out a way to back down from some of the militarization of the state of Israel, which seems to be a big part of this problem.
Absolutely, and it really points to the fact that the United States cannot credibly broker peace between Israel and the Palestinians as long as the United States is arming Israel to the teeth, because under international law, when you provide weapons to one side in an armed conflict, you've broken the laws of neutrality, which is exactly what the United States does. And the Obama administration has been quite proud of the fact that it's provided unprecedented levels of military aid to Israel, which doesn't encourage Israel to negotiate, doesn't encourage Israel to treat with the Palestinians on the basis of equality, on the basis of human rights, on the basis of international law, but the exact opposite. It reinforces this mentality that the United States will continue to give us weapons and continue to lead us in this process that is trying to enforce submission onto the Palestinian people. And that's really a recipe for failure, really recipe for disaster. And as long as the United States is providing Israel with $30 billion in weapons over the next decade, there's no way it can be a credible broker of Israeli-Palestinian peace.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. We're speaking with Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. The Israeli rights group B'Tselem has condemned the Hamas attack, which killed four Israeli settlers just prior to the start of peace talks in Washington, D.C. They called the attack a violation of international law. B'Tselem has also criticized the Israeli Authority for its tendency to respond to Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians by in turn committing more violations of human rights and international law. On their website, B'Tselem pointing out that Israel has employed an undeclared policy of leniency and compromise toward Israeli perpetrators. They continue to document incidents of settler violence against Palestinians, including killings and illegal theft of Palestinian homes. The imbalance in protection of basic human rights for Palestinians will no doubt be a major stumbling block in ongoing peace talks. We asked Josh Rubner to explain his group's response to the Hamas killings.
Well, in general, I'd say we believe in a framework and principles of human rights and international law. So any act by any party, whether they're a government or they're an armed movement, that falls outside the boundaries of what's considered customary international law is something that we would condemn. So we condemn any acts of intentional targeting of civilians as a war crime, whether it's conducted by a government or by an armed party.
Josh Rubner, the campaign has been working on boycott and divestment, and it seems as if there's been a lot more attention paid to that. Could it be one of the consequences of what's happened in the news recently, Hamas killing four settlers, or could it be a sort of fallout from failed talks that the boycott and divestment and sanctions movement is a little bit affected? I mean, in other words, could that even be a secondary goal here?
Oh, I think that's a primary goal in the mind of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of his consideration of entering into talks right now. They're not at all about establishing peace, but they're about easing the growing international isolation that Israel is facing across the globe because of its apartheid policies towards the Palestinians. And one thing that concerns Israel much more than Hamas attacks, much more than the difficulties of negotiations, is the fact that it is facing this growing international movement, successful international movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which in many ways is really analogous to the increasing isolation that the apartheid regime in South Africa faced in the 1970s and 1980s, which of course was a huge precursor towards ending apartheid in South Africa. So the Israeli government sees the writing on the wall and sees that without this charade of negotiations, it will continue to face more and more pressure. But really, the international global activists who are behind the boycott, divestment, and sanction movements, not one of them is going to be fooled into being silent or stopping their activities just because negotiations are resuming. All the more so, we need to keep up the pressure. We need to continue these campaigns to isolate Israel, to critique it and criticize it on the level of global civil society for its policies towards the Palestinian people in order to change the dynamics so that eventually there will be successful negotiations put in place once Israel recognizes that it has to dismantle its apartheid regime towards Palestinians.
In this past week, of course, we've been seeing a story of an investigation in Israel, but some members of the parliament still supporting Yitzhak Shapira the rabbi there who has been under investigation for allegedly inciting the slaughter of quote-unquote Gentile babies. This in his book and in other words that he's put out there in the public domain to be quote-unquote necessary to drive out Palestinians, and no uncertain terms really spelling that out. So talk about what the settler movement has been like and put this in context for us.
The settler population of Israelis living on occupied Palestinian territory now approaches 500,000 people, and it's increasingly difficult to see how these Israeli settlements, which are so intricately tied into the geography of the occupied Palestinian territories, can be removed at this point to create the necessary conditions for a truly viable and independent Palestinian state comprised of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip. And you're right that the settler movement, I think in general, well, I think it's always been a very extremist movement, but I think that very extremist elements within the settler movement are clearly coming to the fore as pressure mounts on Israel to dismantle its illegal settlements. And, you know, we hear a lot about Palestinian incitement against Israelis and against Jews. Well, you know, in Israel and in within the settler movement especially, you have a lot of incitement towards Palestinians. You know, the example you just mentioned is only one. Last week, one of the premier rabbis in Israel, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, called for the death and annihilation of all Palestinians. And the State Department rightfully condemned those remarks as being inflammatory. But the denial of Palestinian peoplehood and the denial of Palestinian human rights is something that's endemic not only to the Israeli settler movement, but really also to the Israeli general public. The whole reason why this conflict has continued for so long is because Israel to date has failed to treat Palestinians as equal human beings, as deserving of human rights, and has imposed upon them the system of apartheid and domination, which I'm afraid these negotiations will not undo.
Talk about what you see as the main criteria that the Obama administration would have to meet in order to initiate real peace talks. I mean, on this end, we've got a lot of armature going to Israel, a lot of arms. We've got a lot of money, a lot of funding to the Israeli state, a lot of basic support. And so clearly the United States, quote unquote, standing with Israel. But what about the terms that you'd like to see laid out?
Well, I think there have to be clear references to both UN Security Council resolutions and UN General Assembly resolutions, which have framed the parameters of a just and lasting Israeli-Palestinian peace for many, many decades. I'll just point to a couple of the key ones. UN Security Council Resolution 242, which was passed in the wake of the 1967 war between Israel and its neighbors, stipulated that Israel had to withdraw from all territory that it conquered in that war, and that includes, of course, the Palestinian West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip, which is recognition of the fact that built into international law, you have this principle that you cannot acquire territory through the use of force, which is exactly how Israel got that territory in the first place. So that's one basis that I would point to. And then the other basis that's being completely ignored by both the Obama administration and previous U.S. administrations, for that matter, and certainly by Israel as well, is UN General Assembly Resolution 194, which was passed in the wake of the 1948 war that established Israel, which says that Palestinian refugees who were driven or left their homes in what is now today Israel have the right to return to those homes and to those properties, and or to receive compensation. And the fact that Israel and the United States have sought to undermine this universally recognized human right of refugees to return to their homes in conflict situations does not augur well for just and comprehensive peace. The rights of refugees need to be respected and recognized and implemented for there to be a just and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
What about U.S. Congress as we look toward another round of elections in America. Do you see any potential for change here that could amount to improvements in this attempt at progress and peace talks?
I'm sure that when Congress reconvenes after its August recess after Labor Day, there will be resolutions introduced commending the parties for getting back to the negotiating table, commending the Obama administration for convening these negotiations. But the weapons will continue to flow unchecked to Israel without any accountability for how they're being misused to commit human rights abuses against Palestinians. And the kind of underlying critical analysis that groups such as ours have put forward will definitely not be taken into account by Congress in terms of predicting the inevitable failure of this round of talks.
And so, Josh Rubner, what is the answer? I mean, what can Americans do if they want to see peace? And let me again mention that this is all in the context, of course, of security for people of both the Middle East and the United States. It is in the context of the quote-unquote war on terror that the Obama White House and State Department and U.S. military operate today. But when we talk about security, it tends to be an isolated form of security and a recipe, as you've said, for disaster. When we say that Israeli security is primary, when we say that American security is primary, and when literally, you know, during the Bush administration, we saw thousands of Palestinian deaths. What about that problem that we're seeing a march toward hopelessness, you know, an ingrained policy again? And what can Americans do? What would you like to see people in both Palestine and Israel do?
That's a great question. And I think that it's Israel and its supporters, which are getting increasingly desperate and concerned about their international image, whereas I think that people who are supportive and working for human rights and equality and justice for everyone in Palestine and Israel are on the ascendant and feeling very confident about what they've been able to achieve. And I think part of the answer to that is for civil society, especially in the absence of political leaders in both the United States and Israel, to insist upon a just resolution to the conflict based on human rights and international law. What international civil society needs to do is engage in these campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and people can get involved in the BDS campaigns that the U.S. campaign is helping to organize by going to our website, which is endtheoccupation.org. And there's also opportunities there to get involved with our organizing campaign to challenge and hopefully one day end U.S. military aid to Israel, which we really see as a precondition and a necessity to set the tone and set the context for successful Israeli-Palestinian peace talks.
Josh Rubner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Josh Rubner is National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. They're holding vigils in Washington, D.C. to call for changes in U.S. policy that would mean more successful peace talks. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed. Underwriting for this program was brought to you by JeremyRHammond.com, political analysis from outside the standard framework. He's founder and editor of ForeignPolicyJournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award. New at JeremyRHammond.com, the piece Turning Back from the Point of No Return, Implications of the Threat to Bomb Iran. He wrote it to counter a public narrative arguing that an airstrike on Iran might be necessary in order to prevent a quote-unquote nuclear holocaust.